You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When the healthcare debate was raging last year, one of the most important life and cost-saving measures never made it into the news, the science of healthcare delivery. This area of study focuses on determining why in one community 60% of children have their tonsils removed by the age of 15, while in a bordering town only 20% will have the same surgery, or why women in one community will have their uteruses surgically removed at a rate four times higher than in a neighboring one. The science of healthcare delivery and why it should receive more attention is the subject of Dr. John Wenberg's book, Tracking Medicine, A Researcher's Quest to Understand Healthcare. It's published by Oxford University Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Dr. John Wenberg to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
You quote Upton Sinclair at the beginning of your book, "It is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on him not understanding." Is that your way of setting the tone for everything that follows?
A little bit. The incentives do matter. They definitely do.
Well, who would you feel is in most need of reading this book, medical professionals or politicians?
Actually, patients, if I had to really say it, because it's an awful lot about what happens to patients depending on which part of the country they live in and doctors and hospitals they use.
Well, the reason I ask about the politicians and the medical professionals is that follows directly from the Upton Sinclair.
Right.
Because in both cases, they have their own special interests in mind.
Sure.
When they take the positions they take.
Sure. Well, I mean, physicians basically have the patient's interest in mind. It's not that it's all pecuniary, but clearly paying piecemeal, you get piecemeal medicine. And part of the real problem in this country is the profound disorganization that our system is in.
Well, also, I've had a doctor tell me when I asked him why he was prescribing so many drugs to somebody, he said, well, that's my specialty. If you go to a surgeon, he says, cut.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the opinion part of the whole equation. Professional opinion differs according to which physician you see.
Would you argue that the surgeries I mentioned in my introduction are recommended too often to patients when they may be medically unnecessary?
Well, we have to sit back a minute and ask what this medical unnecessity means. Basically, it may well work as prescribed. For example, if you have abnormal bleeding from menopause symptoms, removing the uterus does work. The problem is that there's other ways of managing this problem, alternatives, which are in many ways equally effective. And the question is, what is the procedure the patient wants? So it's not just a question about evidence-based medicine. It's also a lot about patient preferences.
So how, in some cases, as you say, you have to take the uterus out if it's cancerous.
Yes.
But other than that, is it really elective surgery?
It really is. Most often it is. And cancer represents, gosh, maybe 10% of hysterectomies.
Mm. So tumors?
They can be managed different ways. The whole point here about elective surgery is that there's an option. There's other options.
Why do we remove tonsils? Don't antibiotics work quite well?
Well, the tonsillectomy story is an interesting one. The epidemic of tonsillectomies is a little bit past, and so we don't do it as much as we used to, although increasingly they're using it for abnormal sleep patterns, snoring, things like this. And we need to trace that one down, too, in terms of the outcomes that really are mattering here.
Which elective surgeries are the most unnecessary and most widely performed?
Well, certainly, hysterectomy would be on the list. You almost have to begin to talk about knee replacement, hip replacements as being the same category. Our sort of measure of, shall we say, discretion is how much do they vary between one region and another. And we see threefold, fourfold differences in the incidence of knee replacements and hip replacements.
Well, since lumpectomies became more common, things have changed a bit about breast surgery, but there are still women who have breasts removed even though they don't have any cancer, simply as a preventive measure. And that's what doctors would have recommended.
Well, maybe some doctors would have. And that's a difficult problem for women who have an unusually high susceptibility to breast cancer. One can't argue that that is not a rational way of managing that problem. I think more to the point is the difference between lumpectomy and mastectomy. for everyday, shall we say, or at least early stage cancer that doesn't have a strong genetic predisposition. And what we're saying here is that that the outcomes in terms of survival appear to be about the same. But what differs are all the other outcomes, and those outcomes matter to women in different ways. Some women just don't want to face the constant surveillance associated with a lumpectomy and the fact that they have to have radiation, and they would rather have a mastectomy. Other women feel just the opposite. The loss of breast is such a problem for them that they really would rather forego basically the mastectomy.
Well, you mentioned earlier that doctors today work piecemeal, and they increasingly specialize in order to make money. Is the way that doctors are paid one of the biggest problems?
I think paying doctors is a problem.
Doctors in general?
Well, paying doctors not in general, but how we pay doctors is a problem, because the incentives in the payment structure clearly drive the incentives in terms of how medicine's practiced. And some of our most efficient practices in the country are those associated with large group practices where physicians are on salary and where there's good coordination between specialties and primary care. And that only is possible because they've gotten away from the idea of the individual solo practitioner. They've come into groups.
My guest is Dr. John Winberg, the Peggy Y. Thompson Professor Emeritus in the Evaluative Clinical Sciences, founder of the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice, and the founding editor of the Dartmouth Atlas of Healthcare. He's also co-founder of the Foundation for Informed Medical Decision-Making and senior advisor to Health Dialogue. He's written a book called Tracking Medicine, which is published by Oxford University Press. You've called your first chapter In Healthcare, Geography is Destiny. What are some of the regional differences that exist in the healthcare industry?
Well, we see pretty much everything that physicians do varies substantially more than could be predicted by illness or, we believe, patient preferences. There's a few things that don't vary, and maybe anchoring the conversation on those would help see why the others are variable. I'm talking here specifically about hospitalizations for broken hips. If you break your hip, you basically know it and you seek medical care. The diagnosis is pretty straightforward. And the decisions that physicians make uniformly is to hospitalize.
Until the bones heal.
Either for surgery or for medical management. But basically, there's no discretion. And that turns out to be very little variation between regions in that one particular procedure. A couple of others that don't vary very much would be things like surgery for people with cancer of the colon, as everybody who has a cancer of the colon basically gets operated on. Beyond that, everything seems to be quite variable from place to place.
And is it different from the East Coast to West Coast, the Midwest? Is it different if you live in a city or in a rural area?
It just depends. For example, there's a consistent pattern of relatively low utilization for chronic illness in the upper Midwest and in Seattle and around in upper New England, which pretty much is associated with group practices and well-organized care. However, surgical variation is all over the place. For example, Miami's rate for doing knee replacement is about one-third that of, or about 30% that of neighboring regions.
Which is interesting because Miami is where a lot of the elderly go to retire.
Right.
You'd think there'd be more knee and hip replacement surgery.
Well, these are being, first of all, we're age adjusting, and so that's not a good explanation. But it's really the local practice pattern of Miami, and we're talking here in comparisons to Fort Lauderdale, or to Fort Myers, which are right across, you know, their neighboring regions. So this striking variability associated with small regions, small areas, can be traced back to the opinion of the local physicians about what's needed and what isn't needed.
And not local laws?
the laws don't seem to have.
Well, Massachusetts has a different health care approach than some other states, but rest of the country pretty much the same?
Yeah, I mean, Massachusetts has its own variations too, so it's pretty much independent of basically the way we are financing care for surgical procedures, for sure.
In upper middle class areas, aren't doctors more likely to be challenged by patients who might have done some research into the various choices that they have?
You'd think so, and I'm sure it's true. But the question
is— More likely to seek a second opinion?
Maybe. But the question is, do we see differences that can be attributed to social class? And it's interesting that within a given region, we don't see much difference. In fact, the rates will be a little lower among the poorer population than they will among the more affluent.
That's because the poor are less likely to be able to pay for an expensive procedure.
Well, this is Medicare, so it's all paid for pretty much by the government. There still is a copayment, and there may be some good reasons not to do it.
You argue in the book that more doctors and more hospital beds do not necessarily lead to better outcomes. What can that be?
Well, it is a little bit counterintuitive. It suggests that more isn't better. And that's one of the paradoxes of American medicine is the assumption that more health care is better. It certainly could be so when you're seeking something that improves the quality of life, but for chronically ill patients, we have no evidence that regions that spend substantially more than other regions and provide substantially more care actually live longer or have higher quality of life than those in more conservative regions.
During the healthcare debate, a number of people who were opposed said that we have the best healthcare in the world. Mm-hmm. Do similar things happen in France, in Germany, mm-hmm. in England, in Australia, and Canada?
Yes.
So you still, if you live in Alberta, it's going to be a little different than if you live in Ottawa?
Not only that, if you live in Saskatchewan or one other city in Alberta, it'll be very, very different. So it's not even associated with states. It's associated with small local healthcare markets. Yeah, the variation problem is all over the world, and we've tracked it not just in the United States, but in the UK and Australia now has a Dartmouth Atlas-like maps showing these variations. So does the National Health Service in the UK.
You did some research on patient choice. We're talking about surgeries for women. But in this case, enlarged prostates, when the men were fully informed of the side effects, in particular sexual side effects of having surgery, they overwhelmingly elected not to have it.
That's right.
So what happened? Did they all die of prostate cancer?
No. Now, these are not patients with prostate cancer. These are patients that have an enlarged non-cancerous prostate that interferes with urination.
So why would they even have any serious surgery?
Well, I guess some men are pretty much bothered by these symptoms, and it's an effective way of treating the symptoms. The problem is that it creates problems with the quality of sexual life. And so it's a real trade-off, sex versus urination. Yeah. And in fact, this understanding was one of the very beginnings of our early work with getting patients involved in what we call shared decision making, namely patients getting involved directly in the choice of treatment, because only the patient can really make those trade-offs between sexual function and urinary tract function.
My guest is Dr. John Wenberg, the Peggy Y. Thompson Professor Emeritus in the Evaluative Clinical Sciences, founder of the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice, also founding editor of the Dartmouth Atlas of Healthcare. His book, Tracking Medicine, A Researcher's Quest to Understand Healthcare, is published by Oxford University Press, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with John E. Wenberg. His book, Tracking Medicine, A Researcher's Quest to Understand Healthcare, is published by Oxford University Press. You argue that healthcare reform should focus on four goals. Should we address them quickly? The first is promoting organized local systems of care delivery that build on the best examples that currently exist.
Right.
Wouldn't doctors be aware of what's going on in the rest of the world?
The point here on organized care is that you really can't manage chronic illness if you don't have a team approach. And
is the Kaiser Permanente approach a good idea?
Yeah, it's a very good idea. So also is the Mayo Clinic ideas and the Intermountain Healthcare in Salt Lake City. And these are organized practices that use electronic medical records. They follow patients. It's teamwork. They have primary care integrated with specialty care. And it's a really important model. In fact, it's one of the most spectacular accomplishments of American medicine, emulated overseas by many, many, many efforts to try to bring the disorganized care that exists there into some form of cohesion.
And you say that the state of American medical services is chaotic. Isn't the problem to some degree that consensus is kind of difficult to reach on what are the best practices? For example, looking at some of the preventive cancer screening recommendations caused serious disagreement among doctors and leaves patients feeling really confused.
Right. This is always a problem, particularly when you're talking about a very specific intervention. I think the thing to keep in mind in terms of the chronic illness story is that what we're talking about that's contributing to these big differences in spending is simply such things as how frequently do you visit the doctor, how often are you referred, how many diagnostic tests do you get, how many MRIs do you get, how often are you in the intensive care unit, and how long often are you hospitalized.
And then we had the whole matter of whether women over 40 should get a baseline mammogram, the colonoscopy over 50. There have been debates over whether pap smears actually do anything, whether just recently we've been hearing that PET scans may very well, and CAT scans may be causing the cancers they're supposed to detect.
Right. And all of that is part of the agenda, basically, that we've got to face. Uncertainty is a dominant feature of healthcare and always will be. We try to provide the evidence one way or the other for these different choices and interventions. Something always new comes up. Ultimately, I think we just have to decide how much are we going to spend on healthcare and say, you know, we can't keep spending and spending for things that we don't know whether they work or not.
Well, just earlier this month, the New York Times reported, I'm quoting, a new study finds that many women with early breast cancer do not need a painful procedure that has long been routine, removal of cancerous lymph nodes from the armpit. Well, the discovery turns standard medical practice on its head, doesn't it? Surgeons have been removing lymph nodes from under the arms of breast cancer patients for almost a century, because they believe that it'll prolong a woman's life by keeping the cancer from spreading or coming back.
That
makes sense, doesn't it?
Well, it makes theoretical sense, but it doesn't, in fact, stand up to reason when you try to do an experiment, namely a clinical trial, and find out what's going on. Breast cancer has a long history of starting with a radical mastectomy, in which the theory was that not only should you remove the lymph nodes, but you should dissect away all the muscles, quote, that's underneath the breast, and you ended up with very, very maiming kinds of procedures. Ultimately, clinical trials showed that procedure was no better than a simple mastectomy. Then the next step was to compare simple mastectomy to lumpectomy, and it came out even, no difference in survival. It sounds to me like this lymph node problem is just a residual of that long period of trying to come down with finer and finer clinical definitions of what works and doesn't work.
Another recommendation you make, and we've kind of touched on this a bit, is fighting misuse of medical services by establishing shared decision-making between the patient and the provider as the norm for choices on elective surgeries and tests and other procedures.
This is, I think, so important, and I'm really pleased that at least the Obama health plan has gotten some recognition of the value of shared decision-making. But let me try to just make a case here for why this is so important.
Isn't that the worst piece of legislation ever passed in the history of the United States? People keep on sending me emails saying that.
Well, it's not the best, but it's certainly not the worst, and it's a start. We should see if we can't make something of it. But let me just say that this whole question about shared decision-making is important because it recognizes that it's not just the evidence that something works in medicine, but it's the question about given the choices for treating a particular condition, what is the patient's point of view? What does the patient want? And so for so long, we've been delegating decision-making to doctors who are assumed to know the answer about what patients want. And this is what we're trying to get at here with the whole concept of shared decision-making.
But in your own practice and research, haven't you found that a lot of patients want to be told what to do to get better and not be given a choice?
That's the way the traditional doctor-patient relation was structured, and we taught the patient well to
do as I
to
say.
Do this.
Just do it, and
or
then the
doctor, what would
God.
You do? But that simply is not sustainable at a time when there are options, when there are differences of outcomes associated with the options. We've got to get beyond this to the democratization of the doctor-patient relationship.
Do you think it would cut down on some of the statistics you quote, rather startling, on the number of people who have the wrong surgeries in this country?
We certainly know from the clinical trials of decision aids, which are this intervention I'm talking about, that patients make better choices once they're well-informed. Basically, they know what's up. They know what the options mean. And secondly, they tend to choose procedures and treatments more in line with their preferences, what they really want. For example, in the case that we were talking about earlier about surgery for an enlarged prostate, men who were concerned about sexual function, once they knew what the trade-offs were much more interested in taking watchful waiting rather than surgery.
A listener wrote in on our show page, the discussion regarding women and hysterectomies is oversimplified. When a woman comes to me with a benign problem and hysterectomy is an option, I make it clear to her that this is one in a series of treatment options, including no treatment. Medical management for uterine bleeding is always my first line of treatment, and hysterectomy is not the only surgical method that can be used for treatment. If a woman is living with bleeding daily and has multiple visits to the ER for bleeding and has needed blood transfusions due to blood tests, hysterectomy is a valid and often the best option for a patient.
Surely, I wouldn't disagree with that at all.
But I don't think we said anything different. I think what happens is doctors sometimes get defensive when you're talking about this because they feel that they're being criticized, and to some degree it's because of one of the big issues that keeps on coming up whenever we talk about these things. Many people feel that if we just simply change the way we handle malpractice insurance and lawsuits, that we would solve all of these problems.
Yeah.
What's your feeling? After all, it came up just again where somebody said, well, we don't need the Obama health care bill. What we just simply need is a change in malpractice suits and put a cap on the awards.
Yeah, I think that certainly is one opinion, but it doesn't really jive very much with what we see in terms of our practice variations. For example, a lot of the claims are that malpractice is behind the variability that we see, but we see very little correlation between the incidence of malpractice and the overall use of care. In fact,
doctors practicing defensive medicine?
Maybe doctors do practice defensive medicine sometimes, but it doesn't explain practice variations, and it won't cure the whole problem of cost, that's for sure.
My guest is John Wenberg. His book, Tracking Medicine, A Researcher's Quest to Understand Healthcare, published by Oxford University Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. The third area that you recommend is the one that we started with, and is the core of your argument, that by strengthening the science of healthcare delivery, it would be possible to save lives and reduce medical costs dramatically. Can you explain in greater detail what the science of healthcare delivery is?
Well, certainly it's more than the traditional clinical trials, which we've used as our major screen on effectiveness. It focuses on the relationship between capacity and the supply of resources and the utilization of resources, of services, asks questions about whether more healthcare is better in the aggregate, and emphasizes that organized care is essential for the long-term follow-up of patients.
Wasn't this area of science previously well-funded, but not recently?
At one time, I thought we had a major breakthrough in establishing the science of healthcare delivery. It was around the time of the early Clinton efforts to reform health care. George Mitchell, senator at that time, had introduced with David Dernberger legislation to focus on practice variation and on the outcomes of research, the outcomes of care in this setting. There was ample funding for a number of teams that were looking at the whole question about hysterectomy, prostatectomy, asking the questions about what's going on with the different theories and so forth. And there was a lot of really very solid research that was published at that time. And it became the basis for the general idea that patients need to be informed about treatment options. But it basically did not survive some of the political turmoil that happened after the Clinton health plan failed.
Well, and you say that this area of science is the least well understood by policymakers, mm-hmm. because sometimes the science gets lost in the political debate?
I think that's part of the issue for sure. It's also that to really understand how important it is, you have to go through this window or this debate about why is it that healthcare in the United States isn't the best in the world. We've made so many assumptions that everything is that's done is, we sometimes say, manifestly efficacious, sort of like manifest destiny, and it just isn't that way.
So when people in Congress say we have the best healthcare system in the world, do you flinch?
I've gotten used to it.
Well, what do you think they mean?
I don't know what they mean. I do know that people have been very proud of our system, and certainly we have some very fine teaching hospitals. We have very fine trained doctors, but we still have the most expensive system in the world, and we rank towards the bottom of the list in terms of outcomes that are sometimes thought to be related to healthcare. So from the objective facts, we simply don't make that claim or can't make that claim.
Your ideas, as I understand it, are well received on both sides of the aisle. So is it possible to get consensus on how to improve healthcare?
I don't know. We'll see. The debate right now is focused on issues that are not on my agenda. I can only hope.
The fourth and final area that you recommend be dealt with is constraining undisciplined growth in healthcare capacity that fuels the upward spiral in spending. Can you explain that?
I think so. The concept of moving towards organized care and to implementing shared decision making as means of improving the quality of care and containing costs is definitely a long-term strategy. But how long that's going to take and how much effort that's going to require is hard to estimate. And changing the culture of medicine is not easy, as you can imagine. So we need several other kinds of steps. We need to take several other kinds of steps to keep this spiraling upward cost curve from essentially bankrupting us. And in my book, I deal a little bit with those issues.
Well, the costs to some degree are because of tests and other things, aren't they?
There are tests, hospitalizations, referrals, just the sheer intensity of care that is given. And all of this intensity of care, by the way, is related to the overall capacity of the system. The number of MRIs you buy for a hospital definitely reflects the number of MRI exams that are done. The number of hospital beds you build affects the utilization rates. ICU beds affects the number of people that are going to be in intensive care units.
Years ago, I spoke to one of the developers of the MRI, and he said when he went to General Electric with the idea, they turned him down because they just thought it was crazy. Mm-hmm. So he did it on his own, and that was one of the reasons why the whole thing became so much more expensive. But here we are in a situation where MRIs obviously have been very helpful. They've changed medicine. And at the same time, we see them prescribed much too often.
Right.
So how do we balance that? I mean, I want an MRI if I have a herniated disc. I want to know just what's going on. On the other hand, it's going to cost me a heck of a lot of money in the way things are now structured.
I think that the people that I'm associated with in terms of the science of healthcare delivery would dispute whether you really need that MRI for that purpose, but.
Oh, gee, I wish you told me when they gave it to me.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to get into anything personal here, but the issue of what works and what patients want is always an underlying theme here. But what we do know is that the number of MRIs that are done is highly associated with the overall costs because they lead to the discovery of new conditions and problems. So everyone's getting multiple diagnoses, and we're basically converting a lot of people who were apparently healthy into people who are, you know, sick.
Well, lest listeners are concerned, the back is fine, but it was actually physical therapy that changed it, not anything that was the result of the MRI.
Mm-hmm.
As the Republicans begin their campaign to dismantle the health care legislation that was passed last year, what are your chief concerns?
Well, there's so much to be done, and there's enough in the bill in the right direction. For example, the idea of creating organized care systems is firmly embedded into the texture of that, or into the law, including and some of the so-called accountable care organizations, and the effort to get primary medical homes established will all lead to better organized care. There's a good deal in the bill about shared decision making, about getting patients involved, and it would be this should be maintained. The complaint on some sides is that the cost curve is not going to be bent or not going to be controlled, and I agree with this as an issue, but we need, I think, to take further, stronger positions to try to figure out how to keep from seeing our system always growing. And one way is to pay attention to the number of physicians we train. We're training more and more physicians. As the more physicians go up on a per capita basis, the more costs we get, particularly when they're specialists.
Just one more thing, a listener writes, and the question is really, how do medical teams find the time to help patients become well-informed? Because doctors are so rushed, usually for reasons having to do with how they're paid, they are rarely willing to be able to explain options and the underlying reasons for those options.
That's exactly right, and that's getting us back to Sinclair's issue about the way you pay a doctor. It's hard to get him to change. And you know, this whole idea of the 10-minute interval between for visits is somehow developed out of the assumption that you should see as many people as you possibly can in an hour because that's more efficient. No way is that the case, as the listener points out.
Johnny Wenberg is the Peggy Y. Thompson Professor Emeritus in the Evaluative Clinical Sciences, founder of the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice, founding editor of the Dartmouth Atlas of Healthcare, co-founder of the Foundation for Informed Medical Decision-Making, and a senior advisor to Health Dialogue. His book, Tracking Medicine, A Researcher's Quest to Understand Healthcare, is published by Oxford University Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.